Go to the wasp, thou sluggard. Evolutionary economics. Natural selection is a miserly economist, invisibly counting the pennies, the nuances of cost and benefit, too subtle for us, the observing scientist, to notice. Human economists weigh up rival utility functions, alternative quantities that an agent, such as a person or a firm or a government, might choose to maximise: gross national product, personal income, personal wealth, company profits, the sum of human happiness. None of these utility functions is correct to the exclusion of others. Nor is there any one correct agent. You can choose any utility function you like and attribute it to any agent you like, and you'll get the appropriate but different result. Natural selection isn't like that. Natural selection maximises only one utility: gene survival. If you personify a gene as a metaphorical agent doing the maximising, you'll get the right answer. But in practice, genes don't directly behave as agents, so we shift our gaze to the level at which decisions are actually taken, usually the individual organism which, unlike a gene, has sense organs to apprehend the world, memories to store past events, computational apparatus in a brain to take decisions from moment to moment, and muscles to execute them. Why, by the way, do biologists find it helpful to personify at all, whether with genes or individuals, to view them as agents? I suspect it's because we are an intensely social species, social fish swimming through a sea of people. So much of what happens in our environment is caused by the deliberate actions of persons. How natural, then, to generalise to inanimate agents. One way this inclination manifests itself is as superstition, fear of poltergeists or spirits, and that's the downside. But the upside is that scientists, so long as they know what they're doing, can use a legitimate personification as a handy and congenial shortcut to getting their sums right. I once heard the Nobel Prize-winning biologist Jacques Monod make a remark that has stayed with me for its imaginative colour. When faced with a chemical problem of this kind, I ask myself, what would I do in this situation if I were an electron? Physicists can explain refraction by personifying photons, adjusting their angle to minimise their travel time through media that slow them down to different extents. A photon is like a lifesaver on a beach, optimising his trajectory towards a drowning swimmer off to one side of the beach. He runs fast most of the way along the beach, then bends his angle to swim inevitably more slowly, choosing his two angles to minimise his total travel time. When photons move from air, fast travel, to glass, slower, you'll correctly calculate the angle of refraction if you assume that they behave like agents, although not consciously calculating like the lifeguard. A stone tossed through the air follows a trajectory as if it's trying to minimise a mathematical quantity that physicists can calculate. In a chemical reaction, you get the right answer if you assume that the reactants are trying to maximise another mathematical quantity called entropy. Of course, nobody thinks these inanimate entities are really trying to do anything. It's just that you get your sums right if you fancy that they are, and the human mind is geared to think in terms of purposeful agents. So biologists shift the focus of our legitimate personification from gene to individual organism. We leave open the question of whether the organism is a conscious agent. We know the gene isn't. The organism takes decisions, calculated, unconsciously is all we need to assume, to maximise the long-term survival of the genes that ride inside it, the genes that programmed, via embryonic development, the nervous system that makes the decisions. The decisions give every appearance of being those of a shrewd economist, acting as if deploying, distributing, eking out, limited resources in the service of passing genes on to future generations. The limited resources of a potato plant flow in from the sun, the air, and the soil. The shrewd economist, which is the plant, has to decide how to apportion those resources between tubers, storage for the future, leaves, solar panels to gather more sunlight to turn into chemical energy, roots to suck up water and minerals, flowers to attract pollinating insects with costly nectar to pay them, stems to hold the leaves aloft to the sun, and so on. Allocating too generously to one sector of the economy, say the roots, and too meanly to another, say the leaves or flowers, will result in a less successful plant than a perfectly balanced distribution to all the departments of the plant's economy. Every decision that an animal takes, whether behavioural, when to tug on which muscle, or developmental, which bits of the body to grow bigger than others, is an economic decision, a choice about the allocation of limited resources among competing demands. So are decisions on how much of the time budget to allocate to feeding, how much to subduing rivals, how much to courting a mate, and so on. So are decisions on parenting, how much of the limited budget of food, time, and risk to spend on the present child, and how much to hold back for future children. So are decisions on life history, how much of life should be spent as a caterpillar, growing by feeding on plants, and how much as a butterfly, sipping aviation fuel from the nectaries of flowers while pursuing a mate. It's economics everywhere you look, unconscious calculations, as if deliberately weighing up the costs and benefits. That's all theory and a bit hand-wavery. Can we go out and record the moment-to-moment behaviour of animals in the wild and calculate their time budgets as examples of their economic decisions? Yes, we can, but it requires more or less continuous observation of individually marked animals in their natural environment, and it can only be done by a skilled and meticulous observer with huge reserves of patience, persistence, intelligence, and dedication. Allow me to introduce Dr. Jane Brockman. I met Jane when she bounced cheerily into my office in Oxford in the summer of 1977. She had been accepted by my colleague and boss, Nico Tinbergen's successor, the idiosyncratically brilliant David McFarland, to do a postdoc. As things turned out, her arrival was delayed a year, by which time David had gone on sabbatical leave, so Jane, by default, worked with me, his deputy. I came to think it a most fortunate happenstance for me, and I like to think that Jane, too, did not regret it. Jane's PhD at the University of Wisconsin was on the great golden digger wasp, Sphex ichneumonious. She came to Oxford bearing large quantities of meticulously systematic observations of the behaviour of individually marked female wasps in two different field sites in New Hampshire and Michigan, and it was on these measurements, originally made for a quite different purpose, more related to David McFarland's field than to mine, that we ended up working together. Not all wasps are social, like the familiar striped vespids known to Americans as yellow jackets, and to all of us as jam-loving spoilers of tea time in the garden. Many wasp species are solitary, and Sphex is among them. Female digger wasps, once mated, do all the work on their own with no workers to help. Males disappear after mating, leaving the females holding the babies. Well, not literally holding. The typical cycle is as follows. The female digs a burrow about 6 inches deep, slightly angled from the vertical, and terminating in a short side tunnel leading to a widened chamber. She then sallies forth in search of prey, which for this species of digger wasp consists of katydids, elegant, usually green, long-horned grasshoppers. She catches a katydid, stings it to paralyze but not kill it, flies home with it, then drags it down the burrow into the chamber. She repeats this several times until she's amassed a tidy pile of up to half a dozen katydids in the burrow, then lays an egg on top of the pile. She sometimes then excavates another side chamber elsewhere in the same burrow and repeats the process with fresh katydids. Finally, she seals up the burrow and proceeds to do the same with a new burrow. Some digger wasp species pick up a small stone in their jaws and use it as a hammer to tamp down the soil, a feat which has been dramatically hailed as tool use, once thought a human monopoly. When an egg hatches inside its secure dark chamber, the larva feeds on the paralysed katydids, fattens on their nourishment, and eventually pupates and emerges as an adult wasp of the next generation, male or female. Although they are called solitary because they don't live in huge colonies with armies of sterile workers, these wasps are in another sense not solitary. They dig their burrows close to where they themselves hatched, so traditional nesting areas naturally grow up. This generates a kind of village atmosphere in a particular patch of ground, with dozens of female wasps going about their separate business, largely oblivious of each other, but occasionally clashing. This closeness enabled Jane to sit in one place with her notebook and watch all the wasps in the area, each of whom she had marked using a system of colour-coded paint spots. She knew every wasp by its code name, red, red, yellow, blue, green, red, etc., and she mapped where each wasp's burrow was, then her next burrow, and her next, and so on. Among much else, Jane had observed that if a female comes across a burrow that another wasp has dug, she may save herself the trouble of digging her own and use the already existing burrow. And thereby hangs the tale we went on to tell. Others, by the way, have told different tales. Charles Darwin was appalled by the cruelty of stinging a prey to paralyse it, keeping the meat fresh for larval consumption, rather than killing it outright. If the prey were killed, it would decay and wouldn't be so good for the larva to eat. We have no way of knowing whether the prey feels pain as its tissues are slowly devoured from within while it is paralysed and unable to move a muscle to prevent it. I devoutly hope not, but the possibility gave Darwin the horrors. According to the great French naturalist, Darwin's contemporary Jean-Henri Fabre, there's something clinically ruthless about digger wasps' precise manner of stinging. Fabre said that they carefully aim their sting, targeting one by one the nerve ganglia strung out along the ventral side of the prey, presumably achieving paralysis with an economic minimum of venom. Philosophers, too, have used Sphex to construct a narrative of their own, stimulated by some classic experiments, again begun by Fabre, and repeated by others since. When a hunting wasp returns to her burrow with prey, she doesn't immediately drag it underground. Instead, she parks it near the entrance, then goes into the burrow empty-handed, re-emerges, and only then drags the prey down. This has been described as a burrow inspection, the idea presumably being to check that there are no obstructions in the hole before she pulls the prey in. It is a well-replicated finding that, if the experimenter moves the prey a few inches while the wasp is down doing her inspection, when the wasp re-emerges, she searches for the prey. Having found it, instead of dragging it straight down the hole, she does another inspection. Experimenters have repeated this tease several dozens of times in succession. Every time the stupid wasp fails to remember that she has only just inspected the burrow, and therefore there is no need to do it again. It appears to be a kind of robotic behaviour, akin to setting a washing machine back to an earlier part of its cycle, say back to wash, when it is about to start final rinse. No matter how many times you do it, the silly machine doesn't remember that it has already washed the clothes. Sphex has even conferred its name in philosophical jargon on this kind of mindless automatism, Sphexish behaviour, or Sphexishness. Jane is one of those wasp watchers who is sceptical of this interpretation. She suspects that the wasp isn't being Sphexish at all. The misunderstanding arises from the human assumption that it is inspecting the burrow. Jane and others believe it needs to approach the prey coming out of the burrow so that when it reverses back into the burrow dragging the prey, its abdomen is aimed in the right direction. So it goes down head first, turns round inside, and emerges head first, so its abdomen is pointing down the burrow when it seizes the prey to drag it down. It's just a way of taking aim, not an inspection at all. Exploring evolutionarily stable strategies. At the time of Jane's arrival in Oxford, The Selfish Gene had only just been published, and my mind was dominated by one of its central ideas, the evolutionary game-theoretic ideas of John Maynard Smith, the ESS, or Evolutionarily Stable Strategy. I was working on a lecture, Good Strategy or Evolutionarily Stable Strategy, to be delivered at a conference on sociobiology in Washington the following year. I'll come to that later. Whenever I heard a story about animal behaviour, such as the stories Jane told me about her wasps, my mind at that time immediately leapt with almost unseemly zeal to translate it into ESS terms. We need ESS theory whenever it happens that the best strategy for an animal depends on which strategy most other animals in the population have adopted. Strategy doesn't imply conscious deliberation. It is simply a rule for action, like a computer applet or a clockwork mechanism. It might be something like, attack first. If opponent retaliates, run away, otherwise continue the attack. Or, begin with a peaceful gesture. If opponent attacks, retaliate, otherwise continue peaceful. Sometimes there is simply a best strategy, in an absolute sense, regardless of what other strategies prevail in the population, and then natural selection will simply favour it. But often there is no single best strategy. It depends upon what other strategies dominate the population. A strategy is said to be evolutionarily stable if it is the best thing to do given that everybody is doing it. Why should it matter what everybody is doing? Because if something else was better than what everybody is doing, natural selection would favour that something. So, after a few generations of natural selection, it would no longer be true that everybody is doing it. That is the original behaviour. It would not be evolutionarily stable. It would be evolutionarily unstable, in the sense that the population would be invaded, evolutionarily speaking, by an alternative strategy, the something else that I mentioned. Some birds have a habit, Jane Brockman herself later, with a colleague, reviewed the scientific literature on it, called kleptoparasitism, a piratical stealing of food from other birds. Frigate birds make a living by pirating fish from other species, as I later witnessed in Galapagos and with Jane herself in Florida. But kleptoparasitism also happens within species, for example, some gulls. Is piracy an evolutionarily stable strategy? We answer that by imagining a hypothetical population of gulls in which almost everybody is a pirate and hardly anybody is doing any fishing. Would it be stable? No. Pirates would starve because there'd be no fish to steal. Imagine you're the sole honest fisher in a population of pirates. Even though you'd stand to lose a fair number of fish to the ubiquitous pirates, you'd still eat better than any one pirate. So a population of 100% pirates would be invaded over evolutionary time by the honest fisher strategy. Natural selection would favour honest fishing, and the frequency of honest fishers would increase. But it would increase only up to the point where piracy just starts to pay better. So, piracy is not an ESS. Is honest fishing an ESS? Mutatis mutandis, we postulate a population consisting entirely of honest fishers. Would it be invaded, evolutionarily speaking, by pirates? Yes, it might well. If you were the only pirate in a population of honest fishers, there'd be rich pickings for you. So natural selection would favour piracy, and the frequency of pirates would increase. But again, it would increase only to the point where it no longer pays compared to the alternative. So we end up with a balance between pirates and honest fishers, balanced at some critical frequency, such as 10% pirates, 90% fishers. At the balance point, the benefits of piracy and honesty are exactly equal. If the ratio in the population should chance to swing away from the balance point, natural selection restores it by favouring whichever strategy is temporarily at an advantage because it is rarer than the critical frequency. It's an important part of the theory that the frequencies we are talking about are frequencies of strategies. This doesn't have to coincide with frequencies of individual strategists, although that is the way I chose for simplicity to express it. 10% pirates could mean that every individual gull spends a random 10% of its time pirating and 90% fishing. Or it could mean that 10% of individuals spend all their time pirating. It could apply to any combination that achieves the 10% frequency of the pirating strategy in the population. The mathematics works out the same, regardless of how the ratio is achieved. By the way, there's nothing magical about 10%. I chose that number just for a simple example. The actual critical percentage would depend on economic factors that would be hard to measure. Indeed, would take a gull-loving equivalent of Jane Brockman to measure. Such matters, to be discussed in my Washington conference lecture, were buzzing around in my prepared mind when Jane Brockman breezed into my Oxford room and we sat down and talked of her wasps. Sometimes they dig, sometimes they exploit the digging efforts of others, and perhaps also the others' haul of katydids. You can just imagine the excitement in my ESS-primed brain when I heard this. Pirates and honest diggers. Is digger an ESS? If the majority of the population dig, would the digging strategy be invaded by a rival strategy called parasitise the digging efforts of others? And is parasitise an ESS? Probably not, because if nobody is digging, there'll be no burrows to hijack. Could there be a critical ratio at which diggers and pirates are equally successful? What excited me is that Jane evidently had mountains of hard quantitative data. Maybe we could use her data to actually measure the economic benefits and costs of the two strategies. Unlike the bird pirates and fishers of my draft Washington talk, for whom nobody had any real data, Jane Brockman's voluminous recordings of the timed behaviour of individually marked wasps had the tantalising potential to turn into the first real field trial of mixed ESS theory. Jane and I decided to work together on the project, but we needed more theoretical expertise, more mathematical wizardry than either of us could muster. It was time to call in the big guns. And the biggest gun in my world was my student, Alan Graffen. It might seem strange to say that my guru and mentor was my own student, but it is true. He was that sort of student. He shared my enthusiasm for ESS theory and helped me to understand its finer points and many other aspects of evolutionary biology. He taught me some of the intuitions and instincts of a mathematician, even if I couldn't follow him through the thicket of symbol manipulation. There are mathematicians and physicists who sashay into biology, thinking they can clean up its act in a week. They can't. They lack the intuitions and knowledge of a biologist. Alan is an exception. He has a rare combination of mathematical and biological intuition, shared, I believe, with his hero, R.A. Fisher, which enables him to smell out the right answer to a problem almost instantaneously, and, like Fisher but unlike me, he can then go on to do the algebra, if asked to do so, to prove he was right. He is now my colleague at Oxford, Professor of Theoretical Biology, and a well-deserved Fellow of the Royal Society. I first encountered Alan in 1975 when he was an undergraduate and I was tutor in zoology at New College and in the middle of writing The Selfish Gene. A tutor from another college had recommended a young man from Scotland as something way out of the ordinary, and I agreed to take him on for tutorials in animal behaviour. In those days, the custom was for undergraduates to read their essays aloud in the first part of the tutorial, and we'd then discuss them. I'd forgotten what Alan's first essay was about, but I vividly remember the goose-pimpling awe with which I listened to it. Out of the ordinary had been an understatement. Alan's undergraduate degree was in psychology. His course had an animal behaviour option, which was why it was appropriate to send him to me for tutorials. I hoped he would go on to do a doctorate with me, but he decided to take the hard option of an Oxford master's degree in mathematical economics, supervised by Jim, later the Nobel Prize-winning Sir James, Merlies, a fellow Scot and one of the world's leading mathematical economists. Economics is increasingly important in evolutionary theory, so this would be a good choice for Alan, whether he came back into biology or made his career as an economist. In the event, he did come back into biology and did his DPhil with me. But when Jane Brockman came into our lives, he was still studying mathematical economics, and he was to make good use of it in the WASP research which the three of us undertook together. First things first, however. The day following Jane's arrival, as she remembers but I had forgotten, was the occasion of the great annual punt race. Less serious than the Oxford versus Cambridge boat race, and probably a lot more fun, its competing teams were those of our Animal Behaviour Research Group, ABRG, and the Edward Gray Institute of Field Ornithology, EGI. The EGI is another sub-department of zoology, named after the former Foreign Secretary and keen ornithologist, Lord Gray, who on the eve of the First World War had intoned the unforgettable lament, "The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime." Both teams deployed an anarchically variable number of punts, flat-bottomed boats propelled by a pole thrust against and all too often stuck in the riverbed. The name of the game was not just speed, but sabotage, and Jane's abiding memory is of John Krebs, later Sir John, now Lord Krebs, FRS, and one of Britain's most distinguished biologists, showing up as especially ruthless on the EGI side. Did Alan perhaps see scope for a little ESS modelling, the honest punter strategy versus the piratical saboteur? Probably not. He has more sense and was too busy honestly poling his punt along. Then it was down to the serious business of wasps. In her two different field sites, the main one in New Hampshire and a subsidiary one in Michigan, Jane had spent more than 1,500 hours meticulously recording the behaviour of individually colour-marked female digger wasps. She had an almost complete record of the histories of 410 burrows and of the nest-related activities that dominated 68 complete wasp lifetimes. As I said, she had originally used these records for an entirely different purpose, which she'd already written up for her PhD thesis at the University of Wisconsin. Together with Alan, we now decided to use the same raw data again to put real, measured economic values on the costs and benefits involved in ESS theory. In my room in the Department of Zoology, with its view overlooking Matthew Arnold's dreaming spires, Jane and I worked together every day at my PDP-8 computer, typing in the numbers from her voluminous wasp records and pushing them through numerous statistical analyses. Alan swung by every few days for a visit, casting his swift and expert eye over our statistics and patiently teaching Jane and me how to think like mathematical economists. We all three worked together on plugging his economic ideas into formal ESS models. It was a magical time, one of the most constructive periods of my working life. There was so much to learn, and I learned from both my colleagues. I like to think I'm a natural collaborator, and one of the regrets of my life is that I haven't done more of it. The first model we tested, colourfully named Model 1, turned out to be wrong, but in textbook philosophy of science fashion, its disproof gave us the clue to inventing the much more successful Model 2. When we first proposed Model 1, we regarded join as a piratical strategy, cashing in on the digging and katydid collecting efforts of honest diggers. All the predictions of Model 1 turned out to be wrong, so we went back to the drawing board and came up with Model 2. Model 2 postulated two strategies called dig and enter. Dig speaks for itself. Enter means enter an already dug burrow and use it exactly as though you had dug it yourself. This is not the same as the piratical join of Model 1, for an interesting reason. That reason stems from an additional fact about the wasps. They quite often abandon the burrow they are working on. Why they do this is not always clear, and indeed the reasons seem to vary. Perhaps there's a temporary problem, like an invasion by ants or a centipede. Or maybe a wasp died while away from her nest. What this means is that an enterer might find a burrow untenanted and assume sole ownership. Or, if the previous owner had not abandoned it, the two would continue to work on the nest, each ignoring the other, except that if they happened to meet in the nest at the same time, which was quite rare because they spent most of their time out hunting, they would fight. Model 2 suggests that dig and enter should be equally successful at a balanced frequency. When lots of digging is going on, entering becomes more successful because there's a good supply of abandoned burrows. But if the frequency of enter rises too high, not enough burrows are being dug, therefore there aren't enough abandoned burrows for the enter strategy to prosper. Now here's an interesting complication. A wasp may abandon her nest at any time, even when she's already stowed katydids in it. So an enterer might stand to gain not only a ready-dug burrow, but a ready-caught cache of katydids too. The model assumes, with justification from Jane's measurements, as she and I showed in a separate paper, that an enterer has no way of telling whether a burrow has really been abandoned or whether the owner is just temporarily out hunting. And we showed, in yet another separate paper, that each wasp behaves as if she knows how many katydids she herself has caught, but is blind to the number that another wasp might have put in the burrow. If a wasp is the sole incumbent of a burrow, whether or not she dug it in the first place, there is a risk that she will be joined by an enterer, and an enterer runs the risk that the burrow she has chosen to enter is still occupied by its original owner. Both these outcomes are less favourable than being in sole possession. This is in spite of the fact that, as the discarded Model 1 emphasised, a shared nest is likely to contain more katydids, two wasps to hunt them, and there is a winner-take-all benefit to the wasp who ends up laying an egg to take advantage of the shared cache. To use informal personifying language, a wasp may dig a new burrow and hope not to be joined by another wasp, or she may enter an existing burrow, hoping it has been abandoned by its previous owner. In Model 1, join was a strategic decision. In Model 2, both join and is joined were undesirable accidents, unfortunate outcomes of a decision to enter. Dig and enter, by contrast, were alternative strategic decisions, At equilibrium, wasps should be indifferent between the two of them. Model 2, if correct, could be summed up in a limerick. There's an insect called Sphexic pneumonius, whose encounters are seldom harmonious. Twixt enter or dig, they don't care a fig, but to join or be joined is erroneous. But how could we measure such benefits in order to compare them and test Model 2? We had to think carefully about the correct way to use Jane's data to assess the benefits and costs accruing to each strategy. The evidence showed that individual wasps didn't use the same strategy every time, so there was no point in totting up the benefits and costs to individual wasps. We had to do the totting up for strategies themselves, averaged across wasps. And to do this, we recognised what we called decisions. The whole of a wasp's adult life was a series of decisions where each decision committed a wasp to a definite and measurable period of time associated with a particular burrow. Each period ended at the precise moment when the next decision was taken, initiating an association with a new burrow, whether dug or entered. Benefits and costs were credited to each decision. Then we could average the net benefit associated with decisions to dig versus decisions to enter. A successful decision was one which resulted in an egg being laid on katydids in the burrow. If the wasp laid two eggs in different chambers in the burrow, the decision was twice as successful. But could we refine our measure of benefit by taking account of the katydids on which each egg was laid? Presumably, an egg laid on a single katydid constituted less of a success than an egg laid on three katydids, because the first larva would be less well nourished. Moreover, not all katydids were the same size, and a quirk of wasp behaviour enabled Jane to measure them. Remember my philosophical digression on sphexishness and the wasp's habit of leaving prey by the burrow's entrance while she goes briefly inside and re-emerges. This gave Jane her chance. While the wasp was down in the burrow, she would quickly measure the length of the katydid, taking care to replace it exactly where the wasp left it, so as not to trigger any sphexish repeats. Volume is a better measure of nutritional value than length, and we approximated volume as the length cubed. In the case of a shared burrow, we credited the sum of the katydids to the benefit score of the wasp who ended up laying an egg on the joint cache, winner take all. This, then, was our measure of benefit, numbers of katydids or estimated volume of katydid flesh on which an egg was successfully laid. How about cost? In a stroke of insight that made a big impression on both Jane and me, Alan urged that time was the appropriate currency of cost. Time is a precious commodity to these wasps. The summer season is brief. They don't live long. Their genetic success will depend on how many times they manage to repeat the burrowing nesting cycle before the season and their life ends. This, indeed, was our rationale for recognising the concept of a decision, a commitment of time by a wasp to a particular burrow for a period terminated by the next decision. Every minute of a wasp's time, then, was accounted as a cost on the ledger of the decision to enter upon a strategy. The net benefit of dig was measured as an average rate, the sum of the benefits from all digging decisions divided by the sum of the time costs. And we calculated the equivalent net benefit rate for enter. Now, this is where we start to think ESS. According to our ESS model, we should predict that dig and enter will coexist at a balanced frequency where their success rates are equal. If the frequency of enter were to drift above this equilibrium, natural selection would start to favour dig, because too many enterers would find themselves sharing a burrow and at risk of engaging in, and perhaps losing, a costly fight, and vice versa. If enter drifts below the equilibrium, enter is favoured, because there are rich pickings among abandoned burrows. The observed frequency of enter in the New Hampshire population was 41%, and we conjectured that this might actually be the equilibrium frequency for the New Hampshire population. In that case, the measured success rate of dig and enter should be equal. So we looked. The actual rates were not identical, 0.96 versus 0.84 eggs per 100 hours, with a similar conclusion for the katydid volume scores. But there was no statistically significant difference between them, and they were close enough to encourage us to test the model further. Alan did some clever algebra, which enabled him to deduce from the model four further predicted numbers, which we could then compare with the observed numbers. The numbers concerned were the proportions of wasps who fell into four categories, and the predictions were the proportions that ought to be observed if the population was at equilibrium, according to our ESS model. I'll give the results in a table. The proportion of wasps who dig then abandon, observed 0.272, predicted 0.260. Dig and do not abandon, observed 0.316, predicted 0.303. Enter and find themselves alone, observed 0.243, predicted 0.260. Enter and find themselves sharing, observed 0.169, predicted 0.176. Nevertheless, we were mindful of the principle that a model whose predictions are not falsified by the observed data is impressive only insofar as those predictions were vulnerable to falsification. If you use too much of the observed data in order to deduce your predictions, the predictions almost can't help being right. We demonstrated by computer simulation, plugging in random hypothetically possible data instead of Jane's real data, that this was far from the case with our Model 2 predictions. The model could very easily have been wrong, yet it wasn't in fact. It had stuck its neck out and survived. Karl Popper would have loved it. Well, it survived in New Hampshire. As if to ram home the point that Model 2 could very easily have been wrong, it actually was wrong in the other population Jane studied, in Michigan. We were disappointed, but stimulated to think constructively about why this was. We came up with various suggestions, of which the most interesting was that the Michigan wasps were adapted to a different environment from the one in which Jane studied them. Perhaps the Michigan wasps were out of date, their genes having been adapted to some earlier set of conditions, somewhat as our human genes are adapted to a hunter-gatherer way of life in Africa, but we now find ourselves in cities with shoes, cars, refined sugar, and other food surpluses. The Michigan wasps were working in a large raised flowerbed, which must have been pretty different from their normal environment, and indeed was different from the more natural-seeming environment of the New Hampshire wasps. In spite of its failure in Michigan, the success of our dig-enter model in New Hampshire was striking, and it remains one of only a few quantitative field tests of Maynard Smith's elegant theory of the mixed ESS. In this case, the mixture is between dig and enter. For me, it exemplified the joy of working in collaboration with compatible colleagues, having complementary knowledge and skills. Consider her ways and be wise. Our work on the ESS model came to an end and was sent off to the Journal of Theoretical Biology for publication, becoming Brockman, Graffon and Dawkins, 1979. The citation engendering, as always, a nice sense of accomplishment. Jane and I continued to work together on a larger paper called Joint Nesting in a Digger Wasp as an Evolutionarily Stable Pre-Adaptation to Social Life. This paper presented and substantiated statistically many of the background facts that we had used in the ESS paper. And it had its own theoretical aim, which was to contribute to the controversial debate over how social behaviour in insects might have originated from solitary ancestors. Could the kind of uncooperative, inadvertent nest-sharing, which we had shown to be evolutionarily stable in solitary digger wasps, have been the forerunner of the massive cooperative colonies of wasps, ants and bees, which are such a spectacular feature of life on Earth? The close genetic relatedness within social insect colonies is certainly an important factor, as my friend and colleague Bill Hamilton had so persuasively argued. But could there have been other pressures predisposing to social life, and could one of these other pressures have been foreshadowed by something like our ESS model in ancient wasp ancestors? Jane and I worked hard on this paper, mostly in her lodgings in Oxford. Tastes and smells are notoriously evocative, and I associate those happily productive times with the taste of Cinzano and a slice of lemon amid clinking ice cubes. And eventually, we published it in the journal Behaviour. The organisation of the paper was unusual in a way that I'm quite proud of and would like to see emulated. The standard plan for a scientific paper was, and still is, the one I had fought a losing battle against during my 4 years, from 1974 to 78, as editor of the journal Animal Behaviour, assisted by the vivacious Jill McFarland, wife of my then boss and predecessor as editor, David McFarland. Introduction, methods, results, discussion. This plan, although dull, makes sense for a certain kind of scientific study in which a single experiment is planned, executed, and discussed. But what if a series of experiments is performed sequentially as each prompts the next? Pose a question, try to answer it with experiment one. The result of experiment one raises a further question, answered by experiment two. Experiment two needs clarifying by experiment three. The result of experiment three provokes experiment four, and so on. It seemed to me that the obvious plan for such a paper would be introduction, question one, methods one, results one, discussion one, leading to question two, methods two, results two, discussion two, leading to question three, methods three, etc. But time after time as editor, I receive papers laid out like this, introduction, methods one, methods two, methods three, methods four, results one, results two, results three, results four, discussion. Seriously, what an utterly bonkers way to write a paper, tailor-made to destroy the narrative flow of a story, kill the interest, emaciate the relevance to the rest of the subject. I struggled as editor to persuade authors to abandon it, but old habits die hard. When Jane and I came to write our paper, we had a narrative flow to offer, even though it took the form of a series of observational measurements rather than experiments. Our conclusions constituted a series of factual statements about the wasps, each one needing statistical justification, and each one prompting a new question, which led to the next factual statement in building up an argument about the possible origins of social life in insects. So we wrote out a summary of our paper, consisting of 30 discrete factual propositions, every one of which we had substantiated with quantitative evidence. Each of those 30 propositions then became a heading in the paper itself. Underneath each heading, the text, tables, diagrams, statistical analyses, etc., were directed at demonstrating the truth of the heading. You could get the gist of the paper simply by reading the headings, and indeed, since the journal required a summary at the end of each paper, we simply reprinted all the headings in sequence as a single summary narrative. The same scheme was independently adopted by Jim Watson in his excellent textbook of molecular genetics, and I was to use a version of it again much later in the last chapter of The Greatest Show on Earth, where I took the famous final paragraph of Darwin's Origin of Species and made each phrase in sequence a section heading of my last chapter. The body of each section was a meditation upon Darwin's phrase. Here is the sequence of headings from Jane's and my paper, which constitute a concise summary of the facts that we demonstrated. Bear in mind as you listen that each one is substantiated in the paper itself by the text, numbers, and analyses that follow it. One suggested evolutionary origin of insect sociality is joint nesting by females of the same generation. Long before selection favoured joint nesting itself, it might have favoured some other incidental pre-adaptation, such as the habit of entering abandoned burrows found in the usually solitary wasp, Sphex ichneumonias. We have comprehensive economic records of individually marked wasps. There is little evidence of consistent individual variation in nesting success. Wasps often abandon the nests they have dug, and other individuals adopt or enter these empty burrows. Dig-enter is a good candidate for a mixed evolutionarily stable strategy. Digging and entering decisions are not characteristic of particular individuals. The probability of entering is not conditional upon whether it is early or late in the season. There is no correlation between an individual's size and her tendency to dig or enter. There is no correlation between an individual's egg-laying success and her tendency to dig or enter. Individuals do not choose to dig or enter on the basis of immediate past success. Individuals do not dig and enter in runs, nor do they alternate. Wasps do not choose to dig or enter on the basis of how long they have been searching. At one study site, digging and entering decisions are roughly equally successful, but at another, entering decisions are perhaps slightly more successful. Entering wasps seem not to distinguish empty, abandoned burrows from burrows that are still occupied. As a consequence of indiscriminate entering, two females sometimes co-occupy the same burrow. Co-occupation should not be called communal because the wasps usually share the same brood cell, not just the same burrow. One might expect that wasps would gain some benefit from co-occupying, but they do not, for a number of reasons. Only one egg is laid in a shared cell, and obviously only one of the two wasps can lay it. Two wasps together do not fetch noticeably more food than one alone. Two wasps together are no quicker at provisioning a cell than one wasp alone. Wasps sometimes duplicate each other's efforts when they co-occupy a nest. Co-occupying wasps often have costly fights. About all that can be said for joint nesting is that it may reduce parasitism. The risk of joint nesting is the price wasps pay for the advantages of taking over an already dug and abandoned burrow. A mathematical model assuming dig-enter as a mixed evolutionarily stable strategy has some predictive success. If the parameters changed quantitatively, the Sfex model could come to predict selection in favour of joint nesting as such. The selection pressures would have to be very strong to overcome the demonstrated disadvantages of co-occupying. Variants of the Sfex model may be applicable to other species and may help our understanding of the evolution of group living. The theory of evolutionarily stable strategies is relevant not just to the maintenance of behaviour, but to its evolutionary change. Our conclusion was that the dig-enter model which fitted the New Hampshire population of Sfex ichneumonious could, if named economic parameters were to change over evolutionary time, move into any of a number of spaces, including social space. We took our model 2 and calculated what would happen if we systematically varied two of the terms in the algebra, namely B4, the benefit of joining, and B3, the benefit of being joined. Would the model yield a stable ESS at different values of these two benefits? The New Hampshire population of Sfex ichneumonious is stable in aggressive space, where the wasps are better off being alone. Our analysis showed that the model allows a smooth gradient as the B values change over evolutionary time through tolerance space, where wasps who are joined do better than lone wasps, but joiners do worse, to cooperative space, where joiners do better than lone wasps and wasps who are joined by enterers do best of all. All the way along this evolutionary gradient, there are stable solutions, such that both digging and entering would be favoured at the changing equilibrium frequency. Our analysis showed that, even without the strong kinship reasons, which undoubtedly apply in many cases, social behaviour could evolve from a Sfex ichneumonious type of ancestor. And of course, close kinship only adds to the pressure to become social and stay social. Interlude in Florida. In 1978, Jane's year at Oxford came to an end, and we sadly relinquished her to the University of Florida in Gainesville. But we three musketeers were to be reunited. In 1979, I took a sabbatical leave in Jane's Gainesville lab, and I arranged for Alan to join us towards the end of my time there. Jane was by then working on another species of solitary wasp, Tripoxylon pilitum. These mud daubers are related to Sfex and have similar habits, but instead of digging burrows underground, they build aerial burrows up on walls, under bridges, on rock faces. The aerial burrows are tubes built of mud, carried dollop by dollop from streams. The tubes often are stacked side by side, hence the name organ pipe mud dauber. Having built its tube, the wasp then provisions it, like Sfex, except that Tripoxylon hunts spiders instead of katydids, and they pack a succession of them into one tube, separated by mud partitions. Jane worked under a bridge on these wasps, recording the comings and goings of marked individuals, just as she had with Sfex. Alan worked with her on the theory, and we both spent time under the bridge with Jane and some of her students, helping to observe the wasps, and dodging the cottonmouth snakes, which frightened me more than they frightened the natives. I loved watching the building behaviour of these wasps, partly because I was writing the extended phenotype at the time, and animal artefacts played a starring role in my argument. I was especially charmed by the wasp's habit of exploiting what looked to me like the physical phenomenon known as thixotropy, as a kind of welding technique. When a wasp returned to her tube with a ball of mud in her mouth, she would apply the ball to the lip of her tube. She then buzzed her wings noisily, and the vibration transmitted through her jaws visibly caused the mud to melt like quicksand. Not just the new ball of mud, but, I suspect, although I couldn't see for sure, the mud of the lip of the tube, so they melted into each other. Melting, melding, welding. It did indeed look like welding. Just about the only skill I learned in the vaunted workshops of Oundle School, as I recounted in An Appetite for Wonder. In fact, it looked to me as though the vibration was acting on the mud in the same way as the heat of a welder's acetylene flame acts on metal, temporarily liquefying the lip so that the new mud bonded securely with the old. Jane doesn't think anyone has published this thixotropy suggestion before, so I offer it here for what it's worth. Jane and I conducted a graduate seminar in evolution and behaviour at Gainesville, in which we were joined by two other professors. My chief memory of these weekly gatherings was the way in which they became increasingly dominated by the intellectual power of Alan Graffen. On the face of it, he was just a graduate student among many and one of the youngest, but it was remarkable how we all, students and professors alike, fell into the habit of turning to Alan to resolve our difficulties and tell us, in his sharp Scottish tones, how to think clearly about them and reach the correct conclusion. My Florida sabbatical wasn't all wasps and work. Jane, Alan and I were joined by Donna Gillis, a friend of Jane's from the zoology department, and the four of us set off to discover more of Florida. We went on drives to Disney World, Alan insisted on taking all the most hair-raising rides, and SeaWorld, Alan was the first to volunteer to be pushed into the pool by a performing seal. We went to the university's Seahorse Key Marine Biology Research Station on the Gulf of Mexico coast, where we self-catered and slept in dormitory bunks. We saw limulus, horseshoe crabs, although they aren't crabs at all, but distant relatives of spiders. Jane later did research on these living fossils. We saw thousands of ghost crabs, they really are crabs, scuttling into their burrows as we approached, leaving their easily traced footprints. Most memorable was the phosphorescence in the sea caused by the disturbance of microscopic organisms in the plankton. We played ducks and drakes, skimming flat stones over the water and watching the glowing ripples as the stones struck the surface. Donna danced on the night beach, her toes in the wet sand inscribing patterns of glowing and then fading phosphorescent blue, charmingly singing of herself in the third person. She's dancing. On another beach, Alan and I swam naked, which alarmed Jane and Donna because, to Alan's and my surprise, apparently it was and is illegal even at night. Now that I think about it, an incident many years later gives me reason to believe the illegality really is taken seriously in the United States. The anthropologist Helen Fisher and I were skinny-dipping in Lake Michigan one warm summer night after a hot day of conference speeches at Northwestern University. A police car drew up on the road 100 yards away. It was dark, so I don't know how they had spotted us, but they trained a searchlight on us and bellowed through a bullhorn, "You're subject to arrest! You're subject to arrest! You're subject to arrest!" Panic-stricken, without waiting to get dry, Helen and I tugged our clothes on as we ran. No such incident marred Alan's and my rather swift and brief dip in the moonlit Florida waves. I suspect, with hindsight, that we did it for reasons of bravado more than enjoyment. Jane now tells me she discourages her students from swimming off that particular beach because one often sees sharks there. Back at Gainesville, much of my time on this sabbatical was spent writing chapters of the extended phenotype, taking advantage of the library and consulting Alan almost daily on matters of evolutionary theory and how to think straight about it. But I also spent time collaborating with Jane, again relying heavily on advice from Alan, on a new paper called Do Digger Wasps Commit the Concord Fallacy? The Concord Fallacy. Economists recognise the sunk cost fallacy, throwing good money after bad. Before I'd heard of it, I had recognised the same error in the context of evolutionary biology and named it the Concord fallacy, first in a 1976 paper in Nature, which I wrote jointly with an Oxford undergraduate pupil, Tamsin Carlyle, and then in The Selfish Gene. Here's the definition of the Concord fallacy in the Oxford Dictionary of Psychology, edited by Andrew Coleman. Continuing to invest in a project merely to justify past investment in it, rather than assessing the current rationality of investing, irrespective of what has gone before. Thus, gamblers often throw good money after bad in an attempt to escape from escalating debts, and the length of time a female great golden digger wasp, Sphex ichneumonious, is prepared to fight over a disputed burrow depends not on how much food there is in the burrow, but on how much she herself has put there. The wasp that has carried the largest amount of prey into the burrow being generally least willing to give up fighting. The phenomenon was first identified and named in an article in the journal Nature in 1976 by the British ethologist Richard Dawkins, born 1941, and his undergraduate student, Tamsin R. Carlyle, born 1954. Also called the sunk cost fallacy, especially in decision theory and economics, named after the Anglo-French supersonic airliner the Concorde, the cost of which rose steeply during its development phase in the 1970s so that it soon became uneconomical, but which British and French governments continued to support to justify past investment. Another name I've used is the "Our boys shall not have died in vain" fallacy. During the mounting opposition to the Vietnam War, as I remember from my tear-gas-dodging days in California in the late 60s, one of the arguments against pulling out went something like this. "Lots of Americans have already died in Vietnam. If we withdraw now, they will have died in vain. We can't let all those boys have died in vain, so we have to go on fighting." And a whole lot more of our boys will die, but we don't mention that. Jane and I were mildly disturbed to find, on reanalyzing her data, that her Sphex digger wasps appeared to commit their own version of the Concord fallacy. Here's how. It doesn't often happen that an entering wasp meets an incumbent at their shared burrow, but when they do, they fight, and the loser usually flees for good, leaving the winner in sole control of however many katydids the two wasps have gathered. Presumably the wasps are fighting to determine who gets the burrow, which is valuable to both of them. The value of the burrow is larger when there are lots of katydids in it, and that value should be the same, you might think, for both wasps, regardless of who caught the katydids. So, if the wasps behave like rational rather than Concordian economists, you would expect both to fight harder for a well-provisioned burrow than for a scanty one. But that is not what happens. Instead, Concord fashion, each wasp fights as if the value of the nest is determined by how many katydids she herself has caught, regardless of the true future value of the burrow. This showed itself in two ways. First, there was a statistical tendency for the wasp who had contributed the most katydids to end up winning the fight. Second, the duration of each fight was correlated with the number of katydids that the loser had contributed. Here's the Concordian rationale for that result. Each fight comes to an end when one decides to flee, and this defines her as the loser. A Concordian wasp will give up early if she has contributed few katydids, late if she has contributed many. Hence the correlation between fight duration and number of katydids that the loser had caught. Jane and I fretted, half-jokingly given my role in naming it, over the fact that digger wasps appeared to commit the Concord fallacy. Was it just that, in John Maynard Smith's jocular phrase, natural selection has bungled again? We sought advice, as ever, from Alan, who pointed out a number of things. Animal design, like design by human engineers, is not perfect in some absolute sense. Good design is always constrained. A suspension bridge is not guaranteed to withstand all conditions. The engineer designs it as cheaply as possible within a specified safety margin. What if, for some reason, the sensory and nervous apparatus that a wasp needs to count katydids in a shared burrow is costly, while the apparatus needed to measure her own effort in catching katydids is cheap? The most economical design of wasp might then indeed look Concordian, especially if, as is indeed the case, sharing of burrows is not very common. As it happens, there is some indirect evidence that the nervous sensory apparatus a wasp might use to count prey is indeed costly to run. It comes from a related genus of digger wasp, Ammophila, studied in the Netherlands by Gerard Barens incidentally the first graduate student of my old maestro, Nico Tinbergen. Unlike Jane's Sphexic pneumonius, Barnes's Ammophila campestris is a progressive provisioner. Instead of gathering a full store of food, laying an egg on it, and then sealing the burrow and leaving, Ammophila campestris brings food, caterpillars, not katydids in this case, daily to its growing larvae. Moreover, it has two or three burrows on the go at any one time. The ages of its larvae are staggered, and their food needs are correspondingly different. The wasp knows that younger larvae need less food than older larvae, and she feeds them unequal quantities accordingly. But now here's the surprising fact. She assesses the needs of each of her larvae only during a single early morning inspection round of all her burrows. After the inspection round is over, she behaves for the rest of the day as if she's completely blind to the contents of the burrows. Barnes showed this in a neat experiment. He systematically switched larvae around from burrow to burrow. No matter how small the larva now in a particular burrow, the wasp would continue to feed it the large prey appropriate to the larger larva who had occupied the burrow during the morning inspection round. And vice versa. It is as though the wasp has an instrument for measuring the contents of a burrow, but this instrument is costly to run, so she switches it on only once a day during the morning inspection round. The rest of the day, the apparatus is switched off to conserve running expenses. This would explain the blunders made by the wasps in Barnes's experiments, blunders compatible with the view that they were now blind to burrow contents. Of course, such blunders would not normally matter because, in the absence of a Barnes, larvae don't hop from burrow to burrow. Ammophila campestris really needs its assessment instrument because its normal habit is progressive provisioning of multiple burrows housing larvae of different ages. But even so, it severely limits the time it is switched on. Sphexic pneumonius, working on only one larva at a time and sharing burrows rather rarely, doesn't have such a strong need for this costly apparatus, so it never switches it on or doesn't possess it at all. It therefore appears to commit the Concord fallacy. This, at any rate, was how we rationalised our results. And really, we shouldn't have allowed ourselves to be disappointed by the wasp's performance, especially if they are as sphexish as some philosophers believe. Intelligent humans in positions of power commit the Concord fallacy, and humans make decisions a lot more silly than that when assessing risks, costs and benefits, as psychologists such as Daniel Kahneman have shown us.